Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale. Coming up next on the Wet Fly Swing podcast.
I came off the water and there was a fella sitting in a lawn chair along the river with his waders. He was smart enough to know that the lawn chair was more comfortable than the rock. He was just watching it, you know, waiting for fish to rise. And we struck up a conversation about how many years we'd been fishing there and where was he from. He was from Bucks County, Pennsylvania. And then we talked about how many people were on the river and how crowded it got. And he said to me, he said, "I don't know if this river can withstand this kind of pressure."
That was Steve Borst on some of the challenges of increased fishing pressure on your home waters. The Delaware River and a couple of passionate fly shop owners today on The Swing.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how's it going today? Thanks for stopping by the show. Quick reminder, the Stonefly Net build-out is going on right now. This is where Stonefly Nets is giving away one of their beautiful custom wood landing nets right now. You can head over to wetflyswing.com/giveaway for a chance to enter to win this beautiful net. We're also going to be following the journey after we choose a winner and watching this net build out occur. So check it out right now. Today's episode is sponsored by Tressel, who you know from their game-changing telescopic fly rod roof rack systems. But did you also know that Tressel just released the only universal bike rack system designed exclusively for the angler and outdoorsman? You can check out this new universal rack system at wetflyswing.com/Tressel right now to see their full line of gear-carrying products and the Artist Series apparel. That's Tressel, T-R-X-S-T-L-E. Tressel, live your pursuit. Today's episode is sponsored by Eastern Idaho's Yellowstone Teton Territory, Idaho's most renowned zone for fly fishing, from the Henry's Fork to the South Fork of the Snake and all the high alpine lakes and streams in between. Yellowstone Teton Territory provides anglers and other outdoor enthusiasts with all the information they need to plan their next big trip. You can visit wetflyswing.com/Teton right now to get the full list of outfitters, lodges, fly shops, and all kinds of inspiration to get you started on your next trip to Eastern Idaho. That's Teton, T-E-T-O-N, wetflyswing.com/Teton. Scott Meyer and Steve Borst are here today to take us into the Delaware River system. We find out a little more about the history of the Catskills in this part of the country, which streamside guide is a must-have for this area, and what their remote deer camp cabin is all about. They take us into deer camp, so this is good to hear a little bit about what they are fired up for this year. Dry is in New York, Art Flick, and Hunting Trout. Here we go, Scott Meyer and Steve Borst from BlackDogOutdoorSports.com. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great.
How are you doing out there, Steve?
Doing pretty good. Can't complain.
Awesome. Well, we're going to dig into what you guys have going at Black Dog, and you're in a hot spot for fly fishing. We have a lot of listeners out in the Northeast, and you know, the Catskills, the Adirondacks, there's all these names that everybody's pretty much heard about, and we're going to dig deep into that, probably maybe even talk some migratory fish as well. But take us back real quick. Let's just start with both of you guys. Scott, let's just start with you. Tell us how you first got into fly fishing and how that came into Black Dog real quick.
I got started because my father-in-law, Steve, here, for my birthday, basically hooked me up with a fly fishing setup about 15 years ago. And nice. I dabbled in it for, you know, 3 or 4 years. And then I started doing a lot more of it and really enjoyed it. And I've just been, you know, practicing and kind of keeping the momentum going. And we have a lot of really great fishing around here. So you can kind of do anything with it around here.
This is cool. So, and I wasn't totally expecting this. That's why this is great. It's always a nice surprise. Is Steve, you've been doing this like 40 years. You've been fly fishing and you got Scott into it. He's your son-in-law. So let's jump into you and then we'll kind of circle back around to Black Dog. So how did you get into fly fishing and come into the Black Dog?
Well, when we started a family 40 years ago, my wife went back to work and she was working second shift. So I was home taking care of my son, Colin, and he was 5 and 6 months old, and it was winter time, and I was bored out of my mind. So a couple of my friends had made their own fishing rods via kits from Cabela's. So I said, well, I think I'll make a fishing rod for something to do. But I didn't need any spinning rods, so I said, maybe I'll make a fly rod because I had this old Fluger Medalist kicking around. So I made a fly rod, and of course, it was still winter time, so I talked to a couple of my friends, and they said, well, you should start tying flies. So next thing you know, I buy this kit and a couple of books, and I'm scrounging around looking for materials. I happen to be a pretty enthusiastic hunter, both waterfowl, bird, and deer hunting, so I had some parts from animals. So I started tying flies, and hadn't even wet a line fly fishing yet. So I made a rod and was tying flies. And as you might expect, come spring, I was desperate for the ice to melt and the water to be fishable. So that's how I got started.
Yeah. So this was like early, mid 1980s?
Yeah.
Right. And then when did Black Dog, I don't know the whole history there. When did the shop start?
Well, I was, my dad, when I grew up, my dad ran a part-time gun shop in the basement of our house. And I would come home from school every day and hang out in a gun shop. And so the shooting sports and firearms and so on became, one of my passions as well as hunting and fishing. And our career was a family business. We were in the tire and auto repair and heating oil business. And that became really difficult to make a living with for a lot of reasons. Everything we sold were products and services that people really needed to buy, but really didn't enjoy buying. So I decided in around 2010 that I would do what my dad did, is start a part-time gun shop. And I quickly discovered that I enjoyed going to work every day a lot more doing that. And my customers, you know, I was selling them something they wanted to buy, and they were all happy customers. So over the course of time, we, my brothers were partners with I, we got out of that business, and I bought a new location where we are now in Glenville. And we opened up the shop here. It was much larger. And in the probably 2 years ago, we decided, because I announced that I was going to phase out and retire, and the boys said they didn't know if they wanted to pursue the firearms industry anymore because of legislation, and
oh, right.
New York State is a difficult state to do business in. So we identified that there was no fly shops in the area. There used to be one, and due to a bad marriage, they went out of business.
Oh, wow. What was the one that went out of business?
That was Goldstock Sporting Goods, and they were only a mile and a half away. And being a fly fisherman, I knew there was a big void. There was no place to go. Even if you wanted to buy leader and tippet, you couldn't find any place close by. So
it was a destination kind of. You picked a river to go to, and there may be a shop by it.
Yeah, yeah.
Gotcha.
So about 2.5 years ago, we made the transformation. We turned the store into an outdoor sports center. We've got paddle sports and a big fly fishing department.
Camping and hiking.
Yeah. And my son is now, he got his guide's license, and he's going to start doing some guide work. And I believe Scott is going to pursue that as well.
Nice. What rivers are you going to be? I'm not sure how the guiding works up there. Can you guide everywhere? Or do you have to guide on select rivers?
It's a general license, which gives you access to kind of all of New York, if you will. It just depends on, you need a few different certifications if you're going to take somebody out on a boat or off.
Gotcha.
But waiting wise, New York is pretty open to you.
This is awesome. Yeah, I love the, I mean, this is cool, and we hear a short snippet of the story, but it's pretty cool because we have you, Steve. You've been doing this a long time, and, you know, this passion of just outdoor sport, and that makes sense, right? The outdoor, Black Dog Outdoors, because, you know, I mean, we all love all the sports. It's not just fly fishing. I mean, I'm a hunter. I love hunting, and it all goes together. Do you guys find, like, when somebody comes in your shop, do you find that, you know, it's a small, like it's a very diverse group of people, or is there one sport that people are really coming for, or is it fly fishing the main thing at your shop?
We do a lot of fly fishing. You know, it's hard to put an exact percentage on it, but, you know, we do have a good selection of people looking for different adventures, whether it be hiking, camping, paddling is, a large component of what we do, kind of quality outdoor goods, as well as ammunition and shooting supplies. So, you know, we've got a decent selection and just try to get the best for.
Almost every day we continue to see new people come in that didn't even know we were here. And that's one of the humbling things, is that, you know, you think that, okay, we're going to put a sign up that we're, a fly fishing shop and paddle sports and so on. And we're on a road that has a lot of traffic, and yet still people walk in and they go, geez, I've driven by, but I never knew it was here.
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
gotcha. So what is your, I mean, what are the rivers? If you guys say kind of your home waters, maybe, you know, Steve, maybe we could just start with you. And since you've been out there a long time, I mean, is there, when you think of New York fly fishing, are you covering, you know, do you guys cover everything, or are there specific rivers that are really your, like your home water?
Well, I think that, a lot of people, because we have so many choices, have their favorites. So, you know, our customers go, you know, to the Au Sable up in the Adirondacks and many other streams. You know, the Scroon River is a popular destination. The Cateros is a local stream. The Battenkill, which, you know, comes out of Vermont into New York. But there's a lot of people that go to the Catskills. And again, similar distance. My personal favorite, because of where I live, I fish the Catskills 90% of the time.
Oh, you do? Good.
Yeah. Yeah. Mostly the West Branch and the main stem of the Delaware. I do get over to the Beaverkill and the Willowemoc and so on. That's where I really kind of cut my teeth. So I like going back there for nostalgic purposes.
I gotcha. That's perfect. Yeah. I was hoping you were going to say that, because it's, you know, the Catskills is always one of those, it's just one of those names, you know, that if you haven't been out there, whether it's like the flies, you know, the style of fly, or just the tradition, right? And it seems like that is the place. I mean, they're all great, but I mean, maybe we can take us on a journey down the Catskills a little bit today. Does that work for you guys?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's take it to, I kind of like to start, and we'll circle back around on some of this to dig in more to some of the background here. But let's just say somebody's setting up a trip, because we have a lot of people listening that are, you know, either some are getting ready to retire, or they're just kind of traveling around. They're always interested in hearing about spots. So if they're thinking Catskills and they come into the shop, what are you guys telling them if they're kind of brand new to it, or they're trying to plan a trip?
It really depends on how far they want to drive. Most of the Catskills are about sub 2 hours, you know, from being kind of like the East Branch. And
what's the close town? Remind me again, Scott, what's your own, the town you guys are in is,
we are in Glenville, which is basically, you know, we are in the Capital District of New York. So Albany, Schenectady, Saratoga puts us kind of inside that triangle. And we have, you know, going down to the Catskills, there's the East and West Branch. Those are sub 2 hour drives. The Neversink River, which is not as well talked about, just kind of north of New York City, northern New Jersey, is a little gem down there.
One of the criteria that I always try and base my recommendations on is what experience level do you have? And that's really important for the Catskills, because the West Branch of the Delaware, the main stem, the East Branch, is they're all wild trout fisheries now that have a lot of fish, a lot of large fish.
Brook trout.
No, brown trout
and
rainbows.
Oh, brown and rainbows. Nice.
Yeah. I mean, there are some brook trout that come into, you know, to the main rivers during the cold water from some of the tributaries, but You know, I've had the good fortune of being able to fish a lot of famous destinations, the Henry's Fork, the Madison, you know, Bighorn and so on. And, you know, I think the Henry's has a reputation of being one of the most difficult places to catch fish on a dry fly. And I will tell you that it is no harder or easier than it is to catch fish on the Delaware system. The Delaware system is as challenging as it gets. And due to the fact that, as I said, they're wild fish, they're large. And, you know, that watershed is within a 2 to 3 hour drive of millions of people. People can get there from Philadelphia and New Jersey and Connecticut and New York City. So it gets pounded. And fish that see a lot of fishermen become pretty wise and pretty hard to catch.
Yeah. So that's a Catskill. So the Catskill, I mean, what is the Catskills? Take us there. Why is the Catskills such a, it's got the tradition, but why do you think it's such a destination? Why would somebody really want to go there and check it out?
It kind of has the birthplace going to fly fishing. You know, down on the Beaver Kill, the Willamette, that was kind of the Roscoe Center, you know, was the
Roscoe, New York is self-proclaimed Trout Town, USA. And
it is Roscoe, New York. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's right. That town is right where the Willamette runs into the Beaver Kill. And if people read, you know, the history of fly fishing in the United States, I would agree that is Trout Town, USA. It was, as Scott said, it's really the birthplace of fly fishing in the US. And so it's got a heritage. There are still the Catskill Fly Fishing Center is there. There are still some famous people that have taken residence down there. Lee Wolf moved and put his home down there along the Beaver Kill River. The Deddies, who are famous fly fishers, they're right down there. So there's a lot of history and a lot of heritage. So, you know, is it the best place to go for fly fishing? No, that's arguable, but it's a destination, and I think if people are going to check things off and places they want to go, it's a must go place.
Yeah, it is. So if you guys are getting ready for a trip, I guess right now it's kind of, you know, winter time, or kind of in March now. But how does that look if you're looking out?
I would say we still have fishing. You know, a lot of the rivers that we're talking about. You go upstream far enough and the water's moving and, you know, ice. We've had a really mild winter this year. So I've been fishing all through the winter, whether it be the Battenkill, the Hoosick systems, which are, you know, sub-1 hour drives. There's just a lot of options. You know, if you go farther north, you know, it's a lot colder up there. So those systems kind of freeze up. But, you know, the Battenkill, the Hoosick systems, even the Kinderhook, which is another kind of local stream within an hour, still fishes pretty good during the winter.
Gotcha. Perfect. So there's a lot of opportunity. And then in a more normal or a colder winter, you probably still have some fishing opportunities throughout the year, just when ice is off or whatever. And is that kind of how that looks?
Well, New York just recently changed their regulations. So New York used to close trout fishing the end of September, and they totally went in and overhauled their management philosophy. They used to stock fish almost everywhere, and they basically took inventory of streams and identified if streams had a wild trout population and the potential for that wild trout population to be self-sustaining. And when they identified that, they eliminated stocking. And so they changed a bunch of things. They also changed that you can trout fish all year, but after September 30th, it's catch and release only. So there used to be nobody went fly fishing or even trout fishing in the wintertime, other than the Great Lakes fisheries. But now people get out there, and as Scott said, he's been going. There's a number of people that stop in and out of the shop because we've had a mild year that have been out fishing, and you know, good for them. It keeps the sport alive during the wintertime.
Right. So let's take it back again. So if I was talking to you guys, let's just say we're talking on the phone right now and I'm trying to plan a trip for, say, I got some time in the next year. I want to come up and go up to New York and I want to say maybe even go out on a guide trip with you guys or just go fishing, what would you be telling me? We can go any time. What would be the time we'd be going, and which fish would we be going for?
First question I would ask is, you know, when do you want to come up, and what do you want to target?
Yeah, I would say we could come up pretty much any time. Let's focus on the best time. And then fishing-wise, I mean, I'd love to catch, I mean, some browns, rainbows, you know, whatever, right? I mean, I think just thinking about trout, like where would we be going if we want to focus on trout?
So I think most fly fishermen would prefer to catch fish on a dry fly, although, you do whatever you need to do to...
No, let's take it there. Let's take it as a dry. Let's say this is okay. Like, this is our dry fly school. We're coming up okay. To actually target dry fly fishing in New York.
I live for dry fly fishing. I mean, I will nymph fish and streamer fish only if I have to. So I pretty much have, in my 40 years experience, have identified that we will start seeing Quill Gordons and Hendricksons hatching in the Delaware system around the last week in April. Now, just because they're hatching doesn't mean the fish are coming up to them. But, you know, last year I was on the Delaware April 22nd, and there were caddis and Hendricksons. So, you know, generally speaking, that's when things really start. I would say that the best time is probably the month of May, and depending on the weather, early June. You know, as like most fisheries, as the days get hotter, the water temperature gets warmer, and when it gets too warm, then the insects and the fish really are active only mornings and evenings. So the sweet spot would be during the time of year when you can fish all day and have, you know, targets to fish toward too.
Yeah, and that'd be May. And then if we were coming up in May, what might we be fishing? What hatches might we be getting ready for?
As Steve was saying, you know, the Quill Gordons, the Hendricksons, caddis, March Browns, and
Green Drake. Drakes will start at the beginning of June. And then we see some olives in there. There's a lot of caddis. The Catskill streams, you know, and there are
even
a bunch of different
too.
Yeah, there's a bunch of different caddis hatches. And I mean, you'll be on the river. Last year I was on the Delaware a couple of times, and looked like it was almost snowing out. There were so many caddis.
Oh, wow.
But the frustrating part that day was the caddis weren't hatching. They were just flying around. So there were not a lot of fish rising, but it's, you know, that's what happens.
So another, you know, caddis hatch that we have is the October caddis, which are, well, they're a huge caddis. They're, you know, size 6 to 10. And, you know, I was out on the Loomsack this fall and just happened to run into a few of those, but, you know, not many fish feeding on them actively on the surface.
Yeah, that's always interesting. I always, struggle a little bit with the caddis hatches. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of them, but they're always, I mean, what do you feel? I mean, do you think that the caddis is just as easy fishing as some of the mayfly hatches? What are your thoughts there?
Well, it depends on the water. You know, again, I was talking about the Delaware system. Those darn fish down there, the insect life is so prevalent that you can be on the water and have 5 or 6 different insects on the surface. And of course, the fish have zeroed in on only one. So you're scratching your head trying to figure out which one. And, you know, I've last year I ran into a day where there were a lot of caddis on the water, and the darn fish were, the only thing they were rising to was a spent wing caddis. And it takes you hours to finally figure that out, if you even do.
Right.
You know,
that's awesome.
So, you know, that's what it, I mean, that's the good news, bad news. You know, the Catskill watershed, Art Flick's streamside guide, Art wrote that back in the 60s.
Right.
And he lived on along the Schoharie Creek and, you know, did all of his studies on Catskill waters. And the Catskills have prolific insect hatches. And so the good news is, and that's why I prefer to go down there, I can be to the bat and kill the same distance, but I know that if I go to the Catskills and it's the right time of year, there will be insects and there will be rising trout. You know, I don't want to make that 2-hour drive and get someplace and find out that, geez, everything is the way it should be, but there's no bugs on the water and there's no fish rising.
Right. Right. So the Catskills, you can count on. If you're going there in May, you know there's going to be some surface activity.
Yep.
Definitely. And, you know, like as Steve was saying, you know, we have the Catskills to the south, but, you know, shift the clock, if you will, 3 weeks behind, and you can go up north and you know, the Aux-Sable fishes, like typically in May, it's really high because of all of the snow melt. So, you know, that comes into really good fishing and, you know, in June, really, I would say is probably the prime.
Yeah, Scott was really accurate. You can look at what happens in the Catskills, and then 3 weeks later, the same things are happening in the Adirondacks, typically.
Right. So it's trailing behind. That's cool.
Yeah.
So basically kind of that late April, May, June, and then July, and then it starts to eventually, once it heats up, like are the Catskills still, what's that like once you're in the middle of summer, say July, August?
Well, it's a little more river specific because, you know, a lot of the streams, like last summer, we had a really hot, dry summer, and a lot of the streams were really low, and there were warnings you shouldn't go fishing because you're going to stress the fish. But the East Branch and the West Branch of the Delaware are tailwaters, as is the Neversink. Scott mentioned that as well. And the Esopus
is partial. Yeah.
Yeah. And those rivers have, you can go down to the West Branch of the Delaware River and stand in the water for an hour, and you have to come out because you're freezing, and it could be 90 degrees outside because the water temperature is 52 right. or 54 degrees.
So that one you're fishing. So that one in the middle of summer, you could fish.
Yeah. And there, so you'll see sulfur hatches, all summer. On those two rivers, sometimes not everywhere. You know you have to hunt for them, and then you find any day that's you know, overcast or drizzling rain, and there will be tons of blue-winged olives. You know, but it can be really difficult. You know, they're sometimes size 20, 22s, and
it's a conveyor belt.
Yeah,
of BWOs. Yeah.
But it's, you know, at least if you want to find a place to go fishing and find some fish that you can target. That exists during July and August for sure.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. So pretty much, you know, year around, it sounds like you can fish given the right conditions and that's the Catskills. You mentioned a little bit there, Steve, about just Art Flick, and he's come up a few times on the podcast, and I want to dig in. Do you know a little bit of the history of the Catskills? Can you talk a little about maybe some of the folks up there that, you know, like Art and some other people that have influenced that area?
Yeah. Well, I read Art's book when I first started, and we have some fly tying socials here in the wintertime once a week. And we got a nice group of people that come in. A lot of them are younger people, and a lot of younger people, or even if you're older, if you're less experienced a fly fisherman, they don't really understand all of the insects and flies that are made to duplicate those insects. So,
yep. Right.
I made reference to Art Flick's Streamside Guide, and I think maybe there was maybe 11 or 12 people here, and I think two people had ever even heard of it. So I said, it's a must read. So I dug it out, and I reread the book again myself just about a week and a half ago. And he was a fascinating man. He spent 3 years where he pretty much put his fly rod down and ran around the stream with a notepad and a net, catching insects and documenting what they were and the dates and the times they came out.
He was like an entomologist pretty much, right?
Yeah, well, he wasn't by education, but he had a couple of, he made reference to a couple of people that he knew that were entomologists. So he would carry bottles of formaldehyde.
So that book you mentioned, the Streamside Guide, does that have a little bit of this history in it?
Yeah, oh yeah, for sure.
Perfect. Sure. Perfect.
So he would catch these, you know, whether they be nymphs or duns, and he'd put them in a bottle, and he would give them to his entomologist friends, and they would get the Latin name of the bugs. And so he would, you know, the book has all that information, as well as the 3 year histories recorded the dates and the times, you know, for the whole season of when those insects hatched. And then he, also has photographs of the insects as well as photographs of the flies that he has tied to replicate those insects, and then gives you instruction as to how to tie those flies with the materials. Although some of it's dated because he calls for polar bear fur,
sure,
for a black-nosed dace and seal fur for various other things. So, you know, today we have all kinds of synthetic materials that we can do that with.
Yeah. That's sweet. No, I love it. In fact, I have that book on my shelf as well. My dad I picked it up for my dad, right? And it's a great, I mean, all these books. And so when you reread that book here a couple weeks ago, was it pretty, like, lots of the stuff you're still using today, lots of great information?
Yeah, I think the biggest change that I've really observed through the years is that the use of traditional Catskill dry flies, I don't even see 50% of the fishermen using them anymore.
That's a great question. So why? Because I always have that question, because these are the most beautiful dry flies, right, ever, right? These perfect, you know, how they're tied. They just look, they look way better than a freaking parachute, you know, Adams or something. Yeah. Although I love the parachute too, but why do you think that is? Why are they not used as much? Because they seem like they match the hatch perfectly.
I think that they will still catch fish. But I think that sometimes when you get some of these really finicky fish that are feeding on emergers and not necessarily on duns,
right?
I think that some patterns like your parachutes, and I love fishing with and tying CDC flies with CDC material. And I think that those patterns, compared duns, sparkle duns and so on, they will both appear to the fish as a dun or as an emerger. So I think that's part of the reason why that people have switched over to them, because they probably catch a few more fish on them.
Yeah, that's it. So basically it comes down to, well, like I said, matching the hatch. So the old traditional dry fly can work if it's imitating that perfect part of the life cycle, but there's probably other flies that are more maybe suggestive type patterns that are matching, you know, an emerger or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And I would also add to that, you know, the manufacturers that, you know, we have access to, that kind of classic super slender body Catskill dry, you know, it's not an option, if you will.
You mean it's hard to get?
Yeah.
Oh, really? So you can't get that from like Umpqua or any of these like companies as easy?
There's takes on them, but I think the Catskill flies, they're kind of known for having either like a quill body them or just that super slender profile with that, you know, double half wrap.
Yeah, that's right. That's why some of these other like local fly tires and things like that are the place to go if you could connect with them. Where do you guys get your flies at your shop?
We get them through Umpqua, Rio, Fulling Mills, and we'll have, we'll tie a few as well.
Today's episode is sponsored by Togan's Fly Shop. Togan's Fly Shop provides superior quality products at a great price. They have also a great YouTube channel that you can check out right now with new fly tying tutorials each week. Togan's also has you covered if you're looking for unique in-house products, and they also support many, many of the great brands out there that you know and trust. It's been fun connecting with Justin and the family over the years now, and it's been really cool, a great local fly shop. Togan's is also offering their fly tying box, where they send out materials at a regular cadence where you don't even have to think of it. You just open the mailbox and there's your Togan's pack. And I recently made an order through Togan's, and the experience is always perfect. They've got you covered if you ever have questions or need any help, whether that's a YouTube tutorial or connecting with them personally. Since 2005, Togan's has been over delivering on customer service. And it's time for you to check out Togan's Buzz for yourself. You can head over to wetflyswing.com/Togan's right now to check out their diverse selection of products today. You support this podcast by clicking through that link to Togan's online. That's Togan's, T-O-G-E-N-S. Okay, back to the show. So this is good. So we've got a little feel, a little history. So we mentioned Art Flick, he's huge. Who else would you throw out there when you think Catskills history? Like, are there a couple other people that are just like as big as Art out there?
Well, Lee Wolf and Joan Wolf, from what I was told, that Lee Wolf, and I know this is accurate, he had a home on the Battenkill up in the town of Shushan. And this is after he had really done all of his flying in Canada and mapping lakes and has really, I mean, he was a pioneer in a lot of things. He's got the reputation of inventing the first fly fishing vest, as well as all the wolf patterns and so on. And I was told that he moved down to the Beaverkill because the fishing down there was more consistent and he found better than it was where he lived in the Battenkill. And I'm not sure when he married Joan Salvato, I don't know if you know who Joan is, but she.
Yeah, we've had her on the podcast.
Okay. Okay. So Joan, you know, she grew up in a big sporting family, and she was, I think, world champion woman flight caster. They ended up getting married, and they built this, they bought this little cottage right along the Beaverkill River, which, a side note to that, was is the birthplace of Ducks Unlimited, the conservation organization. And I had the good fortune of I've been a longtime volunteer at Ducks Unlimited, of approaching Joan after Lee had died about putting a cairn up on their property, letting people know that that was the birthplace of Ducks Unlimited. So I helped a friend. We built it and we installed it. And during that time, Joan would come out and bring us chocolate chip cookies and milk. And she offered for us to fish on her private stretch of the Beaverkill, which, of course, we took advantage of. So, you know, those are legendary names. You know, of course, they have the Wolf Fly Fishing School up there. And her son, Doug, who lives down the road in Lou Beach, has the Wolf lineup of fly lines and other, you know, other products, the Triangle Taper, which I find really interesting because I don't know how long ago, call it 25 years ago, they came up with that Triangle Taper design. And now almost everybody in the fly line business makes fly lines that emulate that Triangle Taper.
That's right.
So they were pioneers in that respect as well.
Yeah, they were. They were. That's right. So the Wolves were huge. And Joan was on episode 100 quite a while ago. And it was pretty funny. That was a really great episode. I haven't talked to her in a little bit, but good. So we got a couple of names here. Well, let's take it back to the river. So we're getting ready for this trip, and we're going to be heading to the Delaware. And I guess, so if you are coming earlier, you're probably hitting, is it where you're hitting higher up in the systems, and then maybe later in the summer when it's hot, you're hitting the tailwaters? Or how does that look where you're choosing where to go on the Delaware?
I think a lot of that has to do with water levels. Because it's a tailwater, sometimes the whole dynamics of how those reservoirs and rivers exist were all created to benefit New York City's water supply. So those two rivers, the East Branch and the West Branch of the Delaware Rivers, they run through two distinct different types of habitat. So the East Branch runs through really forested, pristine country.
And what's the town, real quick, Steve, on that? What is the town, that, if you had to say the closest town, the central town around?
So the town where the headwaters of that runs through Roxbury and then Margaretville. And then that's where the dam is. I'm sorry, that's where the reservoir starts. And that's called the Papacton Reservoir. And it's quite large. And where the dam is, that's Downsville. And that's the East Branch of the Delaware. That has the best water quality as far as drinking water is concerned. So that reservoir is used to supply New York City, amongst others, for drinking water. The West Branch comes out of the headwaters are up near Stamford and runs down through little towns in North Courtright and down into Delhi. And that ends up being in the Cannonsville Reservoir. Now that country is all traditional dairy farm and agriculture. So the water quality for drinking is nowhere near as good because it has manure and fertilizers and all of that runs into it. But we all know that stuff makes for good plant life in a river, and good plant life makes for good insects. So that reservoir is, when they drain water out of that, they don't use that for drinking water at all. That river is used to control the flow of the Delaware River downstream so that the salt line does not recede or run inland during the tides. So it's only about, I think it's only about 12 miles long before it meets up with the west or the East Branch in the town of Hancock. Now, the East Branch is probably just under 30 miles long, but it still has cold water running through. But, you know, if you got really hot weather, for that river to run the length of 30 miles, it can get warm. Whereas the West Branch has still got cold water all the way down through for that 12-mile stretch. And again, it's got prolific insect hatches. And then the main stem of the Delaware, you know, that runs down through some beautiful, beautiful country. That goes down through national, it's a national scenic river. In fact, guides that float that river have to be registered with the National Park Service and so on and so forth to float down that river and take good clients.
Gotcha. So which, just on generally, so these rivers are flowing, let's say the east branch of the Delaware, it's flowing, is it flowing just east or where, which way, what's it flowing into?
They kind of intersect. So the east branch will flow southwest and the west branch will flow, I would say almost kind of north-south, but it kicks a little bit to the east where it intersects Hancock.
So the town of Hancock is, yeah, I see it, right? That's where, and you're, that's right on the border of Pennsylvania and New York.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say, that the probably half of the west branch borders Pennsylvania, and then the main stem is a border of Pennsylvania for a long distance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I see it. So basically it's going... Yeah, it basically starts up, they combine at Hancock and then just go south all the way through Pennsylvania, New York in there. And then it's eventually, and they're heading where, or what is it flowing into eventually?
It flows right by, you know, Philadelphia, I believe, and right into...
Oh, right, Delaware, yeah, all the way down. I mean, that's amazing. It's going, I'm tracking it on the map. It's like, wow, Trenton.
Yeah.
Trenton, Philadelphia.
What I have found fascinating about that watershed is that there were never any dams put up in that watershed. And I remember 35 years ago, I would end up, you know, during the middle of the day when the trout fishing was slow, I'd end up over in Fish's Eddy on the East Branch. And the pools would be chock full of American shad that had run all the way up from the Atlantic Ocean, and they were in the East Branch, and we would shad fish. And I mean, you still see shad in that river and hickory shad, and on the right near the junction hole of where the East Branch and the West Branch come together, the last few years they've been catching striped bass that have been,
oh wow,
that run all the way up. Yeah,
amazing. I was at a dealer show this summer at West Branch Angler, and you know, when a person I was with caught a glimpse of a striped bass in the West Branch Angler pool.
So these striped bass are going, I mean, so what you're saying is that these fish, there are no barriers to get them all
correct
the way up to there?
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow, that's amazing. I was just thinking when we were talking about this, because that's obviously why the Delaware River, the Delaware, you know, the state, it comes in right there. There's the huge bay at Delaware Bay. And then, but yeah, I mean, it goes up through, like we said, through Pennsylvania, the border, then up through New York, and then you get into the branches at Hancock. It's a huge length of distance. That seems amazing to me that these striped bass, there aren't barriers. You would think with all the huge cities around, there would be barriers, but there's not.
But even, you know, just east of us, the Hudson River, you know, the first dam that you run into is at Troy, and it's tidal all the way up till Troy.
But there is a dam.
So there's no stripers above that.
Yeah. I mean, that eventually you'll hit dams in the Delaware system when you get to where the reservoirs are, but...
Sure. But that's way up. Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
How many miles is it from Hancock to, if you're just to drive to, say, roughly to Delaware?
I don't know
for sure. I'd say probably over 100.
Yeah, okay. So 100 miles. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Put that in perspective. Good. So this is awesome. I always love to take the broader picture to look out to see where we're at. And the fact that there's stripers is pretty cool coming up there. But it comes down to these West Branch, the East Branch. Really, I mean, these are tailwaters, right? That's why part of the reason these are so amazing rivers, because if it wasn't for that, maybe it wouldn't be the same. I mean, what do you think? Are there natural stretches of stream up there in the Catskills that are just, even without the tailwaters, are still amazing fisheries?
I would say that's more on the smaller brook trout side. You know, typically in the summer when it gets a little bit warmer in the larger rivers, people can head, you know, kind of into the hills and find these little, you know, thin blue lines that are, you know, just
the brookies.
Nice little brook trout streams. You know, a close one kind of right by us is the Westkill flows into the
Schoharie.
Into the Schoharie watershed. Yep. But even if you go north, there's a lot of brook trout streams in the Adirondacks. It's, you know, a proliferation of these small native population
streams,
of brook trout and browns. You know, we have Gasher Brook, our local Clearwater Trout Unlimited study with the DEC, a few years back, and they found native population of brook trout and brown trout, which is a tributary to, our local stream of the Cater Ross.
Oh, gotcha. Right. So these are fish that, like for the browns, they were stocked at some point, probably 100 years ago, and they don't stock it now, but they're just reproducing naturally.
Yeah.
It's an interesting, this is a legend, so I don't know if there's a proof to this, but I asked a number of years ago about the rainbow trout in the Delaware system. And the East Branch and the main stem of the Delaware for many, many years have not been stocked. And that's because Pennsylvania had a very good fisheries management program, and they would not stock any of their rivers or streams that had a wild population. And since a lot of it was bordered with New York, New York honored Pennsylvania's decision. So that's why those rivers have a very vibrant population of wild trout. So I asked the question, how did rainbow trout get in here? The stories are that 100 years ago, there were some very, very wealthy hotels in the Catskills that would cater to people from New York City, and they offered fishing, and they would bring in rainbow trout from the West. And the story was that there was a rail car or two that contained rainbow trout that they were bringing in from the West, and the train broke down along the Delaware River because the railroad runs right along it. And it was hot out, and they were fearful that they were going to lose all those fish, so they dumped them into the river. That's what I was told, and who am I to argue? Sounds like a cool story.
Yeah, it does. It does. And people are loving them. Are you guys loving the rainbows as much as the browns, as much as the brookies, or is there one that you kind of really love fishing for?
Well, I love the big ones. I don't care what I don't care what species they are.
So you don't like the brook trout? The brook trout, those guys, they're just too small. I guess there's some big brook trout too, but I'm thinking more smaller streams. You're not going to get a giant fish.
I love the brook trout because of where I find them. And that's usually in a very secluded wilderness setting where you're not dealing with other people, and their colors are magnificent. We have a piece of property up in the Adirondack Mountains where we do have our deer camp, and we have a nice stream that runs through it, and it's full of brook trout. And you may only catch 5 inches, but they're, we throw them back most of the time, and they're beautiful to look at. They're just, it's a little sense of the wild when you are in those places catching those fish.
Yeah, definitely. Nice. Well, if we have time here, we'll touch on the deer camp. I did want to just jump into the shop a little bit, and maybe you guys can describe, if you're coming, maybe describe the shop for somebody who hasn't been there. What can you expect? What's it take us there? What does it look like? Is it mostly fly shop? Is it a mix of everything?
It is a mix of everything, but, we have a large section of our floor that's dedicated to fly fishing, fly tying. We carry Patagonia, Sims, Reddington, Lamson, Rio, Orvis, Douglas rods, which are a New York company, Winston rods, which are out of Twin Bridges, Montana. And, we try to kind of offer everything that we have flies for, all the fly tying materials to tie them. And, we have it's a smaller shop. I think we're about 2,500 square feet for kind of the floor there. And we pack a lot into it. We also do a lot with Fish Pond. And I don't think I'm missing anyone else, am I?
No, he covered most of them.
Oh, Sage.
Yeah. We tried to, when we decided that we were going to get in the fly shop business, I should say, I said to the guys, I go, look, we need to make sure that we do this right, and we need to make sure that we are fully stocked before we start making announcements that we are a fly shop, because you only have one chance at a first impression, and we want it to be a good one. So if anything, I would say we probably packed the place up with more stuff than we needed to. But when people came in, they said, wow, you guys got stuff. So we're proud of the fact that we have stuff. It's well displayed, good products. And we, we pride ourselves in being knowledgeable about our products.
Right. What are some of the other products, outdoor sports you have in there. So kayak sounds like that's a pretty big one. What are the, what do you have there?
We sell Winona and Current Design kayaks and canoes, Bending Branches paddles, as well as Stolquist, and we're an NRS dealer as well. They also have, you know, started doing a lot in the kind of the fishing raft line, which is cool. You ever hear of Watermaster?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right. They're a good company out of Montana there. Our Big Sky Inflatables. So we carry, you know, we're a dealer for them. I got a Kodiak on the floor. And one on order for myself. Exciting.
Quiet Cat, e-bikes.
Oh, yeah. Right.
And you know, we stock those seasonally. In the middle of the wintertime, it's not a hot seller. So,
okay.
But we also, you know, continue to stock the, as Scott mentioned earlier, ammunition and shooting supplies. Oh, right.
So you don't have guns anymore, but you have supplies.
Yeah, we have air rifles and muzzle loaders, but no regular traditional firearms.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's always interesting on the guns. We don't want to get into politics or anything like that, but it was, I understand kind of where you're coming from, right? I mean, basically selling guns, you've got some changing regulations, and we were up in Canada last year, and I was talking to some of the guys, it was mostly a Canadian crew, and they were talking about handguns, right? That like, basically you can't get a handgun, right? I don't even know if you can sell them in Canada. Yeah. And they were just kind of like, you know, they're all hunters. We're all hunters and stuff. And they were kind of like, kind of pissed. But at the end of the day, they weren't that pissed. I mean, do you guys find like handguns is really a big part of the gun market? Or is it more like people like rifles, hunting, stuff like that?
It was handguns, in spite of the fact that New York is one of the most difficult states to purchase a handgun. You have to have a permit to purchase one. And you have to jump through a lot of hoops to get a permit. But in spite of that, they outsold long guns probably 3-1.
Oh, wow. Yep. So it still is the thing, even though, and hunting, that's the cool thing about New York. You know, I mean, there's lots, right? You got your deer camp. There's tons of opportunities for hunting up there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And we also carry, cater to kind of the upland sportsmen too, as well.
Clothing.
You know, a lot of Orvis clothing.
Oh, right.
We have Kennetrek boots also, which is that's a kind of a
Montana brand.
Yeah, it's a high end, more specialized product for somebody that is serious about their footwear. The Kennetrek is a great product.
How do you spell that?
K N E T R E K.
Yeah, Kennetrek. Yeah, Kennetrek. Yeah, those are good looking boots. Cool. Well, we'll get a link out to that as well, and obviously we'll have a link to your guys' shop so they can take a look. And so you go in there. Is there a, you know, in your shop, do you guys have like a tying, you know, are people coming in there tying flies? You got a table set up and all that?
Yeah, we've been, we did it last year. As you know, this year we kind of ramped it up a little bit more, and we have this back room that, you know, we can hold. I think the most that we've had back here is about 20 people tying flies. It gets a little cramped at 20, but, you know, we have probably 4 large, folding tables that we can all basically form a big table around.
What I found it's really really cool dynamics with our fly tying social is that we invite people to come, whether you're just curious and you want to take a look around, whether you are an experienced tier, whether you're a brand new tier, or whether you just, you know, want to come in and have a beer. And we get all of that. And, you know, what happens every single week is that somebody will come and they'll be either brand new at tying or relatively inexperienced. And then somebody that knows what they're doing will say, well, come on over here, let me show you how to do this. And, you know, it's really cool. People are making new friends and they're sharing what they know with one another. And it's been a
great community.
Yeah. You know? It's very rewarding to host that. And we have a good time.
Yeah, it sounds like fun. Nice. So you guys have a few things going on. Anything else you want to shed? I mean, we've kind of touched the surface on the, that part of the, we're talking about the Delaware, the West Branch, the East Branch. Anything else somebody should be thinking about if they're planning a trip?
I would also say, you know, Steve likes the dry fly fishing. I like it too, but, you know, I'm not afraid to pick up a Euro nipping rod or a streamer rod and, you know, go throw those around. The West Branch of the El Sable River up north is amazing pocket water, and you can nymph some really excellent trout that see a ton of stuff out of there. You know, it's, there's big browns, there's big rainbows. It's pretty awesome, you know, and the setting alone is, you know, you're surrounded by all these kind of higher peaks with, you know, rock faces, and, you know, it's really accessible, too, which is very nice.
And that's the Au Sable up north of you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Near Lake Placid. Most people have heard of Lake Placid.
Yeah. Lake Placid. Perfect.
Up in that same area, there's the Saranac River and, the Boquete River. So there's, you know, there are quite a few, very notable waters to fish up in that
area. Gotcha. That's cool.
You know, the Saranac, the Au Sable, and the Boquete, they all flow into Lake Champlain. There are some dams and natural dams, waterfalls that, you know, fish can't get quite past. But the northern, I think, I don't remember the exact chapter of Trout Unlimited. They basically removed a dam that had a fish ladder probably 7 years ago, and they've noticed a remarkable kind of improvement in landlocked migratory salmon going up the river. So that's something that's very cool.
Right. So Atlantic salmon.
Yeah.
Yes. But they're landlocked. They're not
heading out the ocean, but they are migrating.
Yep. And, you know, the other thing that's kind of just northwest of us is Lake Ontario has these huge runs of, you know, large, well, they have kings and cohos that come in, you know, they migrate in. But, you know, right now, the Salmon River is also actively fished through the winter, as well as a lot of the...
Oh, yeah, the salmon, of course. Yeah,
that's... Yep. So the steelhead are there to spawn. You know, the browns come in kind of for the feast when the kings and cohos are there. And there's some impressive fish that migrate in.
Today's episode is sponsored by Maverick Fly Fishing. They make the lightest Euro nymph reel in the world, which makes your rod more sensitive, casting more accurate, and you can hold your dead drifts longer without the shoulder burn. This reel is so unique, you may not even recognize it as a fly reel. I had a chance to fish the Stinger reel with Jeff on his home river on the Truckee. The biggest thing that I remember is the weight. The weight really stuck out because you can't even barely tell there's a reel. It's essentially kind of like you're holding a rod all day long. I mean, it's that light, and when you're Euro nymphing, that is a key. And the other big thing I remember from that day was catching a fish on my first cast. Pretty cool to be down in that part of the country and have some great success with Jeff. Maverick keeps things simple by offering a Euro nymph product line with essentials you'll need from rod, reel, fly line, and leader system. Euro nymphing doesn't have to be complicated, so let Maverick Fly Fishing get you started right now. You can learn more by checking out Maverick's YouTube channel for some tips and tutorials. And you can also head over right now to wetflyswing.com/Maverick to check out the good stuff they have going. That's Maverick, M-A-V-R-K, wetflyswing.com/Maverick to support this podcast and take a look at one of the most unique and efficient Euro nymphing setups on the market. Okay, back to the show. Yeah, this is good. I mean, I think New York, the more you get into it, you know, you realize like, wow, it's a wealth of resources. Even with all the people, right?
Yeah, we've only talked about the cold water species, you know, but there's just as many options, if not more options for, you know, largemouth, smallmouth, the toothy fellas, you know, the pike and muskie. They're all around us, you know?
Yeah, that's right. How far is Orvis? They're from you guys. They're just kind of east.
About the flagship store in Manchester is about an hour and 15, hour and a half.
Oh yeah, you're right there.
Yeah.
So you're right next to Orvis. How does that feel? Orvis seems like one of those companies that's just obviously they're the company, right? They stand out above,
yep,
kind of above everybody, right? Because they're so unique. What's your take on Orvis? That's pretty cool. You guys have Orvis and everybody else in your shop.
They offer, you know, a vast gamut of products, but their fly rods, their waders, you know, everything they make is good quality, and they have a good selection of, you know, inexpensive products to as much as you want to pay.
But from a company standpoint, I admire Orvis. They put their money where their mouth is. They're definitely conservation minded, not only for the fisheries, but there's a long lineage of heritage in the Perkins family that were grouse hunters and bird hunters, and so they support a lot of really good conservation causes, and that's we like to support companies that do that because we do the same thing.
Yeah, you do. So you guys are, is that a big focus for you guys, hitting, you know, making sure you're supporting those conservation groups?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. We are a business member of Trout Unlimited and actively involved with our local chapter. And I mentioned Ducks Unlimited a little while ago. I'm a 40-year volunteer, past New York State chairman for Ducks Unlimited, still involved, just a wonderful organization. And a lot of these organizations have a lot of crossover. I mean, Trout Unlimited is about water quality and Ducks Unlimited is about water quality too. So there's a lot of things they have in common that help one another for sure. I've been involved with the Rough Grouse Society. We've ran a couple chapter events here. So yeah, we definitely, believe in being involved in the conservation organizations, not just by supporting them, but by digging in and volunteering as well.
Right, exactly. And that's the huge part. Yeah, volunteering. That's always the, sending money is great for sure. That helps, but it's always getting people connected and volunteering and active, right, on the ground, because that's what keeps them going.
Yeah. Our local Trout Unlimited chapter, this year, they've been doing a larger push to rehab some of the Battenkill watershed, whether it be like the tributaries that flow into the Battenkill, to kind of stabilize banks and doing some repair and planting. But, this year we're kind of looking to do more localized stuff that impacts our local water resources, like the Kateros system, the Neskia Thaw, which is a kind of a cool spring-fed little creek in southern Albany County. We're looking forward to helping them out this year, and I'm working on the Kateros section as well.
Nice. Yeah, that's, it always comes back to it. I was just talking to somebody, actually, kind of a family member, brother-in-law or whatever, and we were talking about, actually, he's from New York. That's interesting. He's visiting, he's a doctor out in New York, but he was, I was telling them that because we were talking about, he was actually asking me, like, the stuff I do, right, with the podcast. We're promoting more people to get into fishing, and like, he was kind of like, well, he, in the climbing, area, and it's interesting, right, because of Patagonia and Yvonne Chouinard, mm-hmm. but, he was saying how some of the rock climbing they do, you can't even climb it anymore. Because the pitches are so smoothed out because it's been so pressured over the years. And he was asking about fly fishing. Don't you see that the same thing? Like, literally, you're helping more people get on the river and impact the fisheries. And the way I thought about it was, and maybe you guys, I don't know how you think about it, but I thought, like, you know what? If I get one more person into fly fishing for life, they likely will be a conservation-minded person. I mean, do you guys feel that that's kind of how you see it as well?
Well, I think that's a very good attitude to have about it. I came off of the West Branch of the Delaware 2 summers ago, and it's during the pandemic. There were so many people that were not working, so they went outdoors. And
yeah,
I never fished it that summer on a weekend. I fished it weekdays only, and I never saw so many people.
Right.
And I came off the water, and there was a fella sitting in a lawn chair along the river with his waders. He was an older gentleman, so he was smart enough to know that the lawn chair was more comfortable than the rock. And he was just watching it, waiting for fish to rise. And we struck up a conversation about how many years we'd been fishing there and where was he from. He was from Bucks County, Pennsylvania. And then we talked about how many people were on the river and how crowded it got. And he said, I don't know if this river can withstand this kind of pressure.
Right.
But I thought about that after we parted ways. And, I talked earlier about sometimes how difficult it is to catch fish on that river. And I thought to myself, just because there's 3 times as many people here fishing doesn't mean they're catching 3 times as many fish. I mean, a lot of fishermen on that river will walk off the river that day skunked. So I said, I don't know that all these people are hurting the fishery. You know, at some point you mentioned the rock climbing and the erosion and so on. At some point you have to wonder all the foot traffic and people if they're doing damage to other things in the ecosystem. But you know, as far as a lot of people fishing on particularly on that watershed, they're not really hurting the fish because the fish are smarter than most of the fishermen.
Yeah, that's right. that makes the fish smarter. But yeah, I agree. I think it gets to a point. It's almost like the some of these permitted rivers around the country. You know, you hate to see it, especially when it's your home river. You're like, oh, I don't want to be restricted. But you know, the Grand Canyon is a great example. You know, if you want to fish, if you want to float the Grand Canyon, you know, you got to get a permit, and sometimes it might take you 10 years or longer. Yeah. Like that's the extreme version, but I think some level of that probably, when things are so pressured, like it might have to go to that. I think we've seen positive outlook, results of that.
Yeah. I was on last summer. I had the good fortune of spending quite a bit of time out west, and the Madison River, in July and August has got a reputation of being super crowded. And,
exactly. And like 100 boats, 100 trailers. Yeah. Were you guys seeing out there? Is that a permitted section or is that just open?
No. Well, I was wade fishing, but the point I was going to make is that I would stand there on the river in this particular spot I found to fish, and I would see pickup truck and drift boat driving by like crazy in the morning. And then if you drove down and had a higher view of the river, all you saw was this traffic of drift boats. But I was able to find plenty of water to fish without being crowded. Did I see other fishermen? Yes, I did. But I had plenty of room to fish and had no problem finding fish that I could, that I could catch. So I think a lot of people, and I fished the Madison in the 80s, so if I wanted to say, boy, it was a lot better back then,
right.
Yeah, well, it was definitely, quieter and less developed, but it's still a great fishery.
Yeah, there's still room. It's still that thing where you can hike and walk and get away from some people.
Yeah.
And to Steve's point, I was kind of saying about where we're located, we have so many rivers within an hour of us, and then you triple it when you go, 2 hours away. So, there may be a lot of people that are fishing, but they're not all going to the same river.
No, that's right. Yeah. You guys have a diverse and large state, and, yeah, it sounds amazing. I think that we are definitely, there's people listening now that are from New York and, I'm sure know a lot of these waters we're talking about. So I think what I'll do is kind of, we'll add some links to the show notes for you guys. And maybe before we get out of here, let's just do the 2-minute drill and we'll kind of wrap this thing up. Does that sound okay for you guys?
Yeah, you bet.
Yeah.
All right, perfect. So I wanted to just walk through. We said a couple things along the way. I think we painted the picture of Black Dog a little bit. It sounds like what was the name of the dog? Was there a Black Dog that had a name that's still there?
Well, there's two of them. There's Gunny, who is the senior citizen of the group. She's laying down on the floor.
Is that what the shop, is that where the namesake comes from?
Well, we had Bonnie and Betsy before then. So, I've had labs all my life.
But, oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. We named it before Gunny came along. So there's a nice painting of Betsy that one of my friends had. He played a dirty trick on me. He commissioned an artist to paint this painting of this dog. And it was an actual photograph that he had. And then he put it up for sale at a Ducks Unlimited event. So I had to buy it, of course.
Yeah.
But now we have Kaylee, who is 13 months old, and she's the energy rabbit running around the store all the time. But
gotcha.
Yeah.
And these are bird dogs.
Yeah. They hunt. We do a lot of upland hunting. I do a lot of pheasant hunting with them, and of course waterfowl hunting.
That's right. So there's tons of that in New York too, just lots of upland hunting.
The pheasant hunting is more put and take. There used to be a lot of grouse, and there are still quite a few grouse in the mountainous regions, but a lot of our grouse have been negatively impacted by the West Nile virus. So we're trying to see, hopefully they'll come back from that. But and of course, during migrations, we've got pretty good woodcock hunting as well.
Oh yeah. Cool.
Yep.
Right on. What does deer camp look like? If we were up there with you on deer camp, is that in like October, November?
Yeah, deer camp, our season starts the middle of October and it with muzzleloader, and then it closes the first weekend in December. So it's really long.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Deer Camp is an old log building that was built by the logging company over 100 years ago as their headquarters. And it's located almost 2 miles back on this godforsaken, muddy, rocky road that takes you about 25 minutes to drive in on, and it's less than 2 miles. That'll give you a little context. Off the grid, no electricity, no running water. We do, you know, have a generator, and we catch rainwater off the roofs for washing dishes and bring drinking water. And our facilities are a two-holer out back.
Perfect.
You can go out there with your buddy if you want. But it's a pretty great place. It's off the grid and entirely, meaning no cell service either.
Oh, wow.
And you know, we heat it primarily with wood. We have this kind of large, you know, those large fireplaces of the time where, you know, it's 10 feet wide, right?
Yeah.
And it's super
a giant fireplace, not a wood stove.
Well, we do have two wood stoves. We only use the fireplace if we have an excess of wood or if we want it to look nice.
I was going to say, yeah, at our elk camp, we used to have sometimes a big fire out camping, and yeah, you could burn through some wood pretty quick, right?
Yeah. It's more for an ambiance, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So that's cool. So this is actually an old building cabin that you guys are, you all, and how many people are going up to Deer Camp?
Well, we can sleep 11, but we generally, the average weekend at Deer Camp is between 4 and 6 people. We'll usually have one weekend a year where we'll have 10 or 11. The deer hunting in the Adirondacks is extremely difficult.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, there are not a lot of deer, and there is just massive timber and forest land. And you also have to know how to get around in the woods. You know, if you walk south out of our cabin, you can go 32 miles before you hit another road.
Oh, wow.
So you better have some respect for knowing how to read a map and a compass or have a GPS with extra batteries.
And to complicate it, you know, the area that camp is in doesn't have a lot of large topographical features. So if you spin yourself around a few times, all the hills kind of look the same.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
gotcha.
The first thing I ask a guest when they come into camp for the first time is, did you bring a map and a compass? And maybe 25 or 30% of them say yes. And then I tell them, well, that's okay. If you didn't bring one, I have extras. Now, don't lie to me. Do you know how to use a map and a compass?
Right. That's the next thing.
At least half of them say no. I said, okay, good. This is all important information. We will make sure we don't lose you.
Yeah, I think I will give a shout out to, they're not a sponsor, but Onyx Maps is, a pretty awesome tool. And I've been on the electronics. I mean, that thing is just, it's pretty amazing downloading all the maps. And
Extra
batteries, good tip.
The important thing to know on the Onyx is because we don't have any service, you need to download that map in that location before you get there.
Exactly. Yeah, you got to download the maps. That's the key. That's a key. Perfect. So basically deer camping, you guys, I mean, you go up there with this crew. What is a good season? Like how many animals? Is this like one of those things where if you get one, you're feeling pretty good each year?
We
about three.
Yeah. We
Oh, cool. You're getting some animals.
Yeah. We harvested three nice bucks last year. And we try and practice. We don't kill a year and a half old deer. We passed up a couple of deer last year. Now, if I have somebody that comes up with their kid and he's never shot a deer before, I tell him, shoot whatever buck you want to. It's legal.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so we don't have a, you know, really rigid rule, but you know, my friends and family that have harvested deer before, just, hey, pass up that young one. Let's hope that they get a little bit bigger.
Six or better.
Yeah. Right. Six or better. So like, yeah.
And we've got bear and there's some moose running around. The cool corner of the building is all raked up with claws from a bear.
Nice.
Yeah,
nice.
We like showing that to the new people that come.
Exactly. Yeah, you guys have some bears up there.
Oh, yeah.
Perfect. Yeah, that's the other great thing. Lots of, you guys are so close. I mean, you are up, and I mean, I'm not sure the latitude or whatever, but it's, you know, you're way up there. You know, that's the cool thing about New York, and that's obviously why you guys get the weather. But, I mean, Canada is just, I mean, a drive, right? A few hours away up to Canada.
Yeah, it's about 3 hours to Montreal.
Yeah, Montreal. Yeah,
from camp, from deer camp, we could be maybe less than 2 hours.
Yeah, less than 2 hours. Nice. All right. Well, let's start we're officially starting the 2-minute drill now. So, let's start with you, Scott. So you're heading out to go fishing in May. You only have one dry fly you can take. What is that dry fly?
Green or tan caddis.
Okay. A dry, like a can, would that be like an elk hair caddis?
Yeah. Or an emerger.
Or an emerger. Yeah. Emerging caddis. Okay. And, Steve, for you, what is your one, rifle? What do you got for deer hunting? What are you using?
A 280 Remington bolt action, left-handed mountain rifle. Remington.
Oh, wow. 280 Remington.
Yep.
So that's like a, wow, that's amazing. Cause I always think of like the 270. I have a 270, or I was close to a 270, but the 280. Now, why the 280? Why not a 270 or a 30-06?
All right. Good question. So the 270 and the 280 were created from a 30-06. They're both necked down.
Oh, wow.
And when I decided that I was going to buy that rifle from Remington back a long time ago, I did my research, and the 270 is a wonderful cartridge. If I was only going to hunt deer with it,
yeah,
the 270 would
shoot
be perfect.
Straight.
You can only go up to a 150 grain bullet with a 270, but a 280 is a 7mm. So I can go all the way up to 75 grain. So it's more versatile.
More versatile. Yeah. Yeah. And I was going to say, I have a 7mm mag.
Yep.
So it's got the similar, right? Similar deal. It's the 280. Yep. Right. That's cool. Okay. Good. And Scott, so what is your one rod? So you're heading out, like you can only take one length and weight rod. What are you using out there in that part of the world?
Can I Euro nymph?
Yeah. Yep. Anything.
All right. I got myself a Sage Sense, which is kind of their mid grade rod.
Uh huh.
But that is a phenomenal, you know, phenomenal rod. It has great feel for the bottom or a fish, and
right,
it is effective.
What is the length of that rod?
It's a 10.5-foot 3-weight.
Yeah. So it's a Euro. It's pretty much, you could use it for Euro.
Yep. And
perfect.
I mean, it is just, it's fun.
This is awesome. Yeah. We just wrapped up we're wrapping up our Euro school. We're setting it up. We did a little giveaway event, and we're heading over to kind of the Henry's Fork with Pete Erickson, from Team USA. He's going to run the school for us, and it's all Euro, right? So it's one of those things that we've never done this, but it's a very, you know, people are interested in that, right? It's one of the, whenever we do episodes around that, lots of people are interested.
It is.
Do you guys find that as well? It's an effective way, and lots of people into it.
I mean, what I'll typically do is I'll bring a Euro rod with me, and I'll bring a dry fly rod or a streamer rod. You know, if it's in the colder months, streamer
cover
rod.
It all.
You know, and if something's hatching, dry fly rod.
Gotcha. Perfect. All right. And Steve, what's your one fishing tip? If somebody's out there, they're trying to hit dries in the Catskills, and they're just basically heading out the door, what do you tell them before they leave?
Well, I would say I think a lot of fishermen, they'll either call or go to the fly shop, and they'll take a look at what their chalkboard says is currently going on. And then they have tunnel vision, and they only try two or three different flies because the chalkboard said that.
Right.
I came off of the Delaware a couple of years ago fishing with two buddies, and both of them are very experienced fishermen. And I was just around the bend out of sight from them. And Hendricksons were hatching, and I caught three fish, and I was a little disappointed with myself because there were so many fish rising, but I could only catch three. And I kept thinking to myself, boy, those guys are probably hammering them down there. I should go down there and find out what they're using. I get down there, and neither one of them had hooked a fish, nothing.
Yeah.
And right. I said to my one friend, I said, well, how many times did you change your fly to a different fly? This was over the course of about 4 hours. He said, maybe three. He said, how many times did you change yours? I said, over 20. If you put a good drift over a rising fish and he doesn't eat it, and you do it three or four times, change something. That's my tip.
Yep.
That is a good tip.
100%.
That is a good tip. Yeah, you're basically hunting. I mean, we just had the trout hunter on recently, and you know, because we've been focusing in that part of Idaho. And we were asking him about it, they're looking for heads, you know, they're walking, they're hiking the stream, looking for heads popping up before they even think about casting. And he said, it's like, he's hunting the trout, right? That's kind of what they're doing. So for you, Steve, staying there, you can only, you've got one activity. It's either fly fishing or hunting, and you got to choose one. What are you choosing?
Oh, well, that's a good question. So had you asked me that 10 years ago, I would have said hunting.
Oh, wow.
But I'm 66 years old now, and I've hunted a lot. I've fished and hunted a lot. And I think I hunted so much over the last 30 years that I realized that I don't have time to do everything. And I kind of compromised the amount of time I was able to spend on the river. And this past summer, my wife and I took off for 2 months, and I fished a lot. And I said to myself, I got to do more fishing. And this winter, I've been tying flies, and I'm just like, I can't wait for spring. I'm desperate for spring.
Yeah, that's it. Perfect.
So it's evolved into probably more fishing than hunting, that although I don't have the choice of giving one up.
Right. Yeah, you don't have to. That's just in this scenario, in our 2 minute drill. So, okay. And we'll kind of wrap it up here with Scott, you on your trip. I'm not sure if you have some, like, a bucket list trip you haven't gone on around the country, the world. Do you have one there you've been thinking about?
Oh, so we have a few customers that are well-traveled, and we've got a good friend who just went up to Igloo Lake, which is way up in Newfoundland.
Oh, wow.
Labrador.
Oh, yeah, Labrador. Yeah. Sure.
So they were fishing for...
Just north of you guys, right? I mean, you could drive up there.
Yeah.
Well, you can't drive where they...
Right. Yeah.
But that looked really cool. They were fishing for Arctic char and large brook trout.
Wow.
You know, that inhabit these streams there.
Gosh, Arctic char. I don't even think about that species, but that's up there too.
But another thing that would definitely be on the bucket list is going down to the Keys and going for, tarpon and, permit and stuff like that. I mean, the saltwater thing is, it's really cool. And it's a little bit further of a drive for us here, but, we have access to some good fishing, and, getting those species that you don't get around here is something to travel for.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we just had Bruce Chart on a while back, but he talked about the Grand Slam, right? I mean, they got giant tarpon down there in the Keys. They got the good bone fishing and even permit, right? I mean, there's a chance to get the Grand Slam. Cool. All right, well, and Steve, let's just leave it on you. Give us your, I'm not sure, do you have some thoughts of getting out somewhere before, you end your time on out here as far as a big bucket list trip?
Well, I'll tell you, I got a really good friend who's the Chazens, or where is it? How do they say that? He's there right now. He travels all over the place. So he keeps going these places. And every time he goes to these places, I change my mind as to, maybe I should try and go there. Maybe I should try and go here. I don't feel like I need to be a world traveler to go do it, although some of that stuff is pretty awesome. But, I fished Alaska a couple of times. So I'd say I'd love to go back to Alaska again. And the last time I was there, we targeted rainbow trout, not salmon. So that was pretty awesome.
Right. Where'd you go to Alaska in Alaska?
We fished Lake Creek. We flew in and floated. We got dropped off by a plane. It was four of us, two rafts.
Oh, nice.
Unguided.
Did a DIY, did your own thing.
Yep. And,
cool.
Had I known that there was class 3.5 and class 4 rapids, and I don't know that I would have done it, but I'm here talking about it, so we made it.
You survived. That's the thing about Alaskans and even Canadians I find up in, that part of the world, BC and everything, is that their levels, they tell you like, here's a little class 3. And then you get in and you're like, oh my God, this thing, right? I think their levels, they've just seen more stuff than we have, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good, good. Yeah, I think you're right. All right, guys. Well, we'll send everybody out to blackdogoutdoorsports.com if they have questions for you. And just want to thank you guys both for shedding some light on New York here. And it was really a lot of fun. And we'll hope to keep in touch with you guys moving ahead.
Thank you, Dave. We certainly appreciate our time with you.
Yep. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
So there it is. wetflyswing.com/435. 435, you can get some of the links. Take a look at maybe Deer Camp. Maybe not. We might not have Deer Camp in there, but there will be some links to the stuff we talked about today on the podcast. Quick reminder, the Stonefly build-out bonus is going on right now. You can check in wetflyswing.com/giveaway for a chance to win this custom net from Stonefly. Quick shout out to Brandon Hudson before we get out of here. Brandon left a great email and actually had a great quote. One of my favorites as well. But Brandon reached out and said that he wanted to let me know that he has counted up the episodes he's listened to of the Wet Fly Swing podcast, 182. He says he's listened to 182 of these episodes, and he said that we are a machine. And Brandon entered this recent giveaway, and he said that on the last giveaway, he had to have two devices running, one to catch the feed and the second to answer the questions. We always give away some bonuses on these live events. So this is awesome here, Brandon, that you're on these and enjoying it. This is amazing. Brandon, thank you for checking in and letting me know you've been listening to the podcast and definitely loving you for letting us know. And his little quote at the end says, "The smallest act of kindness is worth more than the grandest intention." I'm going to leave it at that for today. There's not much else you can say right there. That is probably the greatest quote. So I am going to let you get out of here. I'm going to get out of here as well. And I hope you're having a good evening, good morning, or good afternoon, wherever you are in the world. And I appreciate you for stopping in to check out the show today.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.